Welcome to the Protectors Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Piccolo. I'd like to welcome Mark Valley to the show. How you doing, Mark?
Great. Thanks, Jason, for having me.
You have an incredible background. You've been in acting for decades now, but you also started out in the military. And then it looks like you grew up up north, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I grew up in upstate New York on the Canadian border.
How was that?
It was cold. Yeah, I grew up, like, I didn't play hockey, but I was a hockey fan. So, you know, I used to go watch hockey games in Montreal. So it was a strange situation growing up on a border, because on one hand, it's a very American city, but you're right on the edge of the country looking at another country as well. So I like to think I had kind of an international experience up there.
Definitely an international nexus, that's for sure. Now, did you stay there your whole life, or did you move out? Did you join the military right after? Oh, you went to West Point. That's right.
Yeah, I went to West Point. So it's funny. Some people think West Point is like this school you go to when you're 12. You're one of these kids that you got sent to military school for bad behavior or something. But no, it was it's a competitive, obviously a very competitive college, and I got into it. And that was in 1983. Served 4 years. That was around the time. I mean, it was probably 10 years after Vietnam had ended. You know, there were still Vietnam veterans roaming around, and nobody was really talking about it much. It just that there wasn't, the military wasn't a big draw. It wasn't a popular option at the time. But, you know, I had a strong sense of service as a kid as well. Plus, seeing some of these Vietnam guys come back, I felt I had to serve as well. So, yeah, so I went in, and then after that, I served for 5 years. And then I got out and became an actor.
Really cool. Now, what branch did you go into?
Engineer. I was going to go infantry and seriously gung-ho. And then at the last minute, I thought, oh, no, wait a second. One of the things I really like doing is problem solving. And I was a math major in school. So I thought, you know, as an engineer, I might be able to use that skill a little more. So that's what I did.
Yeah, I don't know what I was thinking. I was enlisted artillery, then I branched infantry. I was like, what am I thinking? You know. So, then my wife was an MI officer later on too, so it was kind of interesting.
Oh, were there things she couldn't tell you?
Yeah, I know. Just you know, military intelligence is an oxymoron in the military. We know that one, but
it's yeah.
Just,
yeah.
It's a different world. So did you deploy?
We didn't really call it that. It was the Gulf War, and yeah, it was a strange time. We thought it was going to be a much larger war, obviously, than it turned out to be. I was in Germany at the time, and I think that what they needed or what they were planning for were replacement soldiers once the hostilities had begun. So they went to USAR, like U.S. Army Europe units, and said, "We need, you know, so many from each company." And I was put in charge of a detachment of, you know, more or less disposable soldiers from across Europe. I mean, you can imagine if you're in a company and they say, listen, we need you to send 3 guys to the Gulf War. We don't know if you're going to deploy or not, but we need you to send these other 3 guys on their own to do something. We're not really sure what it is. We weren't getting the best and the brightest. So it was me and like the dirty 4 dozen who, you know, were sent over to Saudi Arabia. It was bizarre. The air campaign had already begun. We had no idea how devastating it was going to be. But we were stationed in Khobar barracks. And when I got there, yeah, I kept asking people, what's going on? What are we doing? And, you know, soldiers, like, we're living in these strange hotels, this strange sort of condominiums. You know, we're just sort of shacking up in there. I mean, it's the same place that was blown up by, I
think, yeah,
about 6 years later. But they said, no, we're you're actually waiting. I said, waiting for what? And it was a little macabre, you know?
I know.
But they thought, well, we'll give you guys something to do. It just so happened that they had a transportation problem. Once the Scud missiles started falling along the pipeline road, a lot of the civilian truckers just said, to heck with it. They're mostly Sri Lankans anyway. They said, we're done. So we needed to move our own goods. And what they were doing was transporting enough goods, you know, material and equipment for us about 6 months of sustained conventional war against the Iraqi army. So I was in a transportation, you know, I just became a convoy leader. We just brought from, you know, 500 pound bombs to water bottles. It was kind of interesting.
Yeah, definitely. But later on in the war effort, I went over to in 05, 06, and I was in Kuwait for a couple months before I pushed north. And it turned into all civilians pushing so much of the goods up north from Kuwait and Iraq. And it's just these massive third country national convoys guarded by a few U.S. troops. What a situation. So now you're back. You're done with the army. Was acting always in your blood?
No, it wasn't. I've told the story a couple of times. I mean, as a kid, I could do impersonations. That was just sort of, I don't know. I always thought that was some sort of skill that humans had for hunting, you know, being able to imitate birds or animal sounds or something. But no, I was imitating humans, and I thought that was kind of fun. But never, I just never really had the real force of performing. Like, I wasn't a kid that wanted to do theater or anything like that. So, but when I got into the army, the impersonation thing became kind of a draw. People thought, oh, can you impersonate Colonel Slauson at his hail and farewell or something. So I would impersonate the officers and I would write little sketches, and that was fun, but it was more or less a hobby, like a side hobby that I would do. And but it was a good audience. I remember getting, you know, trying to a room full of officers in their, you know, dress uniforms. I mean, getting them to kind of laugh at some, you know, raunchy stuff was always kind of fun. But I didn't really think that was a reality until I think it was after I was stationed in Berlin. I was there before the wall came down. I got to live in a big city and see all that. And then I went to the Gulf War. You know, I wasn't in any combat, but then I came back. I wasn't in combat, but it was a weird situation where like Scud missiles were landing nearby and people were dying that I knew. And I was like, what the fuck is going on? I mean, I think some of the guys that signed up after 9/11 had a little more of an idea of what was going on. But for us at the time, we thought, wait a second, did we go to war? Wasn't it a war? I always think that film, God, what was that film with George Clooney and Mark
Wahlberg? Oh, yeah, Three Kings.
Three Kings. There's that one line where Mark Wahlberg is like standing on this berm and he looks over and he goes, yells to him across this kind of desert. That, I mean, you know it. It just kind of like sucks the sound out of everything, right? He just yells, are we shooting guys?
Exactly.
Right? That's sort of what it felt. I mean, growing up listening to Vietnam veterans and, you know, watching those.
Oh, movies, my gosh, I know.
When you're in the shit, you know.
Yeah, it's like you watch Platoon, you're like, oh, man, I'm going war.
Strange, like that. A little surreal. But anyway, that experience happened. And then I came back and I think before that, the Berlin Wall came down. So I was there when the wall came down and I saw that happening. And those are life-changing events where you see something that is so entrenched, is so a heavy part of history and your belief system just disappear literally overnight. It kind of opened my mind a little bit. And I thought, you know, why don't I, if I only have one life to live, you know, why don't I do whatever I want? Or at least give that a try. So that's what I did. So I started looking around for acting schools, and I was an extra on a movie first and saw the circus and thought, wow, this is cool. So I'd really like to, I'm not really sure what this is. I could probably be an actor. That seems to be something I'm pretty good at. That was the easiest way in, and took some classes and started working. And yeah, here I am.
So was your big breakout in soaps?
Yeah. Yeah. I got a job on Days of Our Lives and I played the dashing Jack Devereaux for 3 years.
I got to go back and check that out. My wife and I used to watch Days back in the 90s.
Did you? Yeah, I was Jack. Well, middle Jack. There was a guy, there was maybe three of us that played Jack.
That's what I got to find, which one you were. That's awesome. Now we talked a little bit right before the show about Keen Eddie. That's to me, that seems like one of your, you know, I think that's your breakout role as far as getting into like dramedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was fun. that was, I was the only American actor and like a whole, like a crew of English actors. And, you know, being in that environment where, you know, they're not as precious about acting over there. It's much more of like a, it's like a skill and a craft and a working class sort of thing. There is, it isn't, there's nothing magic or special or even really celebrity about it over there, which was a great experience for me for a year.
Now, you've had a ton of great roles. Human Target, what do you call it? What was the other big one I wanted to talk to you about? Where you played an FBI agent.
Fringe.
Yeah, that's what it was, Fringe. And lately, you've been doing some local work called Zberg, right?
Yeah, I made a web series called Zberg, and I wanted to do a web series. I wanted to start. I'd already directed some episodes of a Friends web series, The Millionaires, and thought, okay, I want to start. I want to do something amateur. I don't want to sort of jump into these big productions. Not that I was being offered that, but I thought I want to be able to make some mistakes. And I wanted to do a web series, and I thought, well, why do it in Los Angeles? There seems to be saturated with it. So why not do it in my hometown and try to show some, you know, local flavor, local communities, as opposed to, you know, two guys that work at a pizza shop in a major metropolitan area or something. So I went to my hometown and talked to some people. I'd written a short story about an experience I had as a kid when I threw a snowball at the wrong car. And that was the starting point. And I got some people together and put a production, and now it's at zbergny.com. And it was a wonderful opportunity to involve an entire community, not only actors and talent and some people that had sort of always wanted to do it, but never really had the opportunity, but also, you know, business people and, you know, government and police, fire and rescue, everybody helped out.
That's really cool. Did you happen to employ any vets in that?
That's a good question. That's a good question. I was thinking about, you know, that's a bigger question to get into is I let me think. Yes, I did. Well, a good friend of mine up there, he's a veteran as well. And, he's been there since day one. He plays one of the police. He's done everything from, you know, transportation, pick me up at the airport. You know, he'll even come up with ideas on the sets. He played one of the police. He's a very funny guy, Chip Bracey. So yeah, he was, he's one of the veterans.
Oh, very cool. Now, the other big thing I wanted to talk to you today was, like, you're very into volunteer work, and you did a short for Myesha Meds. Can you explain, talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, every once in a while, I like to take myself completely out of context of what I'm doing. I've done it before in, I think, Sri Lanka for a little while, then in the Dominican Republic. I worked for about a month for the Clinton Foundation. And there's, you know, some skills I learned when I was in school that along the supply chain stuff, basically, is what it is. So I thought, well, maybe I could do like a work volunteer thing again. I sort of felt the urge. Sort of, I'd been to Africa once before, and I thought, well, I'd love to go to Kenya this time. So I went to Kenya and started working for a medical startup. It's called the Social Enterprise. Is, you know, it's a company that does, it's using technology to solve some, you know, some real world problems in the medical industry in rural Kenya and in the cities. But also it's sustainable. So it's not just an NGO or a charity where you're sending money and they're spending it. They're, you know, setting up a viable business model that can continue on its own. I thought, what a great idea. You know, I know someone that had been looking around for jobs like that for me. So I got there and I was just going to, you know, help them maybe take pictures and help them, you know, maybe do some forecasting stuff or kind of look at the clinics or look at the pharmacies. But it's just, everybody's just so smart nowadays. Everybody had it all. Everybody seemed to have it all figured out, especially these kids from, you know, these young programmers. And so I thought, well, maybe I could help them tell their story a little bit. So I interviewed everybody for kind of in a podcast fashion for them to use on their website. And I thought, you know, what'd be kind of cool is to put together like a short narrative film where I could tell their story, not necessarily a talking head documentary, but, maybe like a quick visual narrative of a, you know, a woman in a rural Kenya trying to get medications for her sick child and everything that this company is doing to try to make that possible. And yeah, I trimmed it down to about 2 minutes, 30 seconds. I slapped on some narration by yours truly. And yeah, I've got a nice little product to pay for my summer vacation. So
now I'm definitely going to link that to the podcast as well. Because that you know, that little short, it touches on a whole bunch of things you don't even think about. Like the counterfeit meds coming across, people think they're getting the right meds, and all of a sudden, hey, you know what? They're not.
And it's a real problem. And it's hard to control it as well, because it's just so huge.
It is. And then, you know, you always think, well, if you're going to spend a lot of money, you're going to give it over here, then people are just going to get meds. But over there, they actually have to have health insurance. They actually have to do the same types of things that we do. And when someone's making maybe $2 a month or $2 a day, they really can't afford those, you know, $30 medications. So if you do have these awesome organizations like Maisha Meds, they could actually give the meds so people aren't dying. I mean, it's simple, but that's the simple factor about it.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about Kenya now is that, I mean, they're, you know, like a lot of governments, they, you know, they have some corruption issues, but they're really genuinely trying to get the bureaucracy out of the way to try and involve some new technologies to solve some problems. So you're seeing this real leap ahead in Africa. I mean, since, you know, generally the early 60s, there was, almost all the countries in Africa gained their independence, and there was, you know, all this colonial residue left over, and this system that they, you know, could or couldn't, you know, in some instances could or couldn't sustain. You know, nowadays it's like, okay, we've got some problems, you have some solutions. Come on over, partner up with some Kenyans, and let's see what we can do. So you're seeing all these innovations in, you know, agriculture, energy, water, power. There's a lot of startups over there that are just sort of, you know, they're not having to deal with a lot of the partisan politics that we have right here. And they're able to kind of implement some broad technological solutions. So
they make it happen.
Yeah, they say, I mean, exactly. We shot with essentially their Surgeon General. Like, I don't really what the equivalent would be, but it was their, you know, director of pharmacies and poisons. And they said, yeah, we love the idea of doing a quick movie. Come on in. Can we shoot in your building? Yeah, shoot us too. We want to be in it. So that was a pretty fun experience.
Yeah, I can imagine. It just happens. It's great. I wish we can get some stuff like that happening over here, but that's another story for another day.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned something, you know, getting back from the war, then all of a sudden you're like, hey, you know what? I want to do something different. I want to do something I've always wanted to do, which not always wanted to do, but something, you know, just completely different. A lot of veterans I've talked to want to get into the acting field. Do you have advice for them?
Yes. Question your motives. That's my first thing is I remember thinking at the time when I was getting out, because I liked to take vacations and, you know, enjoy myself and eat hamburgers and drink beers. But, you know, I've got a sense of service as well. And I remember hearing Robert Kennedy say something about, you know, there are many other ways to serve your country, or to serve people, or to serve your community or your family, besides being in the military, besides being, you know, one of the warriors or fighters or the support. So I kind of took that to heart. One of the things that sort of sustained me was I always felt that I was helping tell stories, or I was helping people feel things who couldn't necessarily feel things when I started out. And I kept that general purpose. I mean, if my purpose was just to become and make it as an actor, or just get work as an actor, that's a little bit hard to sustain, because I think people in some ways might be able to see through that. And, or maybe you don't really know what you're after, but that was my thing, was to kind of ground it in some sort of service related purpose. And that sustained me through my transition, because, you know, you get lonely, you think, wait, this is so much different than being in the military. There's so many more, options and different rules and different, what's the chain of command in this business? I don't know what's going on. What do I have to do? So, that was important for me to maintain a feeling of purpose or a kind of a defined purpose. Other things I would say is I would look into acting as a craft, but it's only one piece of the pie of storytelling or of communicating something to people. And I would stress that, you know, you have to take acting classes. And that was one of the things I brought with me from the military was, well, if I'm going to be an actor, I have to go. You can't just be an airborne ranger, right? You got to go to school for that. And I thought, well, how am I going to be an actor? I've got to go to school for that as well. So I'd recommend, you know, taking classes and working on your craft, but also keeping in mind the bigger picture is, you know, your storytellers, and start learning some other aspects of craft, because I think right now it's just a time where everything is so easy to learn and so available that you can make your own content, and you can make your own good content. And it doesn't necessarily have to be content that is made just to get you another job or just to get you a bigger job. You could make something that you really believe in. And that's sort of what I feel.
That's really great advice. I mean, that's a lot of things I've been picking up. Is another thing is you have to kind of treat it as a job, and in a way, you have to prepare for it. You can't just say, "Hey, you know what? When I'm going to go stand in front of a bunch of people." That's what I'm trying to say. And yeah. Just talk. You know, you actually have to know what you're doing.
And I would suggest that people, and especially military, who want to be an actor, is, you know, get to know the business a little bit more. Because acting is the entry position, not the entry level position. I mean, it's an amazing skill, and you can be really well rewarded for it. But it is the most familiar of the jobs when you're looking at the entertainment industry from the outside. You know, it's like, wait, I can be the guy who's standing leaning against a car waiting for a girl to come out of the cafe. Right? I can be the guy who's on the SWAT team. You look at it like, oh, I can do that job of the person who's performing or doing something, because military is very much a performative environment. You know, you're not. So I'd kind of look at it and then question what you really want to do in that business, because I mean, the Writers Guild has this wonderful veterans writing project for the Writers Guild Foundation. You know, there's all sorts of organizations that are helping veterans get into other areas of the business, and, you know, getting into, you know, maybe joining a crew. Maybe what you really like is operating a camera. Maybe what you really like is directing or even producing. And there's a lot of veterans who just kind of easily transitioned into producing, like Brian Chung. He's somebody you should probably have on here. So I'd look at it like that. Just kind of question, wait, do I want to tell stories, or, you know, am I one of those guys that has to like tap dance on a stage and do something? You know, not to denigrate acting, but, you know, open your mind a little bit, you know, take a good look at it.
And network. That's a huge thing too, is make sure, you know, cause you might want to be the guy, you might not know exactly what you want to do, but mm-hmm. talking to other people, definitely.
Who told you that? Networking.
Jennifer and I were talking about that.
Uh-huh. That's worked for her?
Yeah, networking out with other vets, talking to different people, finding out what your niche is.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful way to get a lot of information really quickly. That's one thing I miss about the military, is instantly you're with 100 people who, you know, 100 different eyes and ears, or hundreds who, you know, are listening to different things, seeing different things.
Yeah, that's what I'm finding out about the podcast world, is you're meeting a lot of different people in a short amount of time and having interesting conversations and learning more. And mm-hmm. that's the greatest thing about these things.
And why'd you get into it?
That's basically it. You know, I had a very, I was doing a lot of political stuff, a lot of news, Fox News, all sorts of stuff. And, you know, I wanted to have a show that just kind of was non-political. I could talk to vets, mm-hmm. LEOs, firemen, and just kind of get inspirational stories and kind of see what their backgrounds are and kind of see how we could all help each other out. That's kind of the whole inspiration for this podcast.
Cool. What else can I do?
What else can you do? Well, for now, you know,
sit here and keep answering questions.
Exactly. Yeah. No, you're doing it, you know, because that's the thing, is people will listen to your story and they'd be like, hey, you know what? I never thought about doing that. Maybe I can do it. and get inspired, you know, not just acting, but to volunteer, to even just like your short, you have a career set and you use it to help other people. And that's kind of one of the inspirations for getting in touch with you for the podcast.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I'm glad you could appreciate that. I mean, a lot of times they look at, I remember this for people will always question like why you do things. Like, why are you doing this podcast? Are you trying to get a job to play a spy in a show? Or like, I have my own podcast, The Life Drop, which is about intelligence and diplomacy. And, you know, you're always going to have that, like, strange suspicion, you know, why are you doing this? Are you doing this to help? How are you going to help yourself? But the truth is, like, every time I do a volunteer activity or something like that, it also helps me as well. I get out of the house, I engage with people. I don't like to just be sort of wrapped up in the business world or the social world of Hollywood. I always try to get out and get my human experience from real primary sources. and those volunteer things give me opportunity for that.
Yeah. And that's kind of like, I love the idea of podcasting, you know, just being able to have just normal conversations with people with not having an ulterior motive. That's kind of a really cool idea about this too.
Yeah. What have you learned so far?
I've learned a ton, man. Leadership lessons from Jason Redman the other day, mm-hmm. kind of talking, learning about how Hollywood works with Jennifer Marshall, Matthew Broderick. Mm-hmm. You have to check out my interview with Jason Schechterle and Benjamin Bruckheimer, both of these guys injured in a line of duty and just driving on. You know, nobody I ever talked to that's been injured, shot in a fire, anything blown up by an IED has let any of that stop them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm learning every time, you know.
What have you learned about interviewing the social craft of having a conversation?
I'm trying to get rid of all my ums, but other than that, I'm trying to just, I don't like to do a lot of research. I mean, I've been following you for a while just because, your background and your work.
Yeah.
I like to learn as I go. I feel if I do too much research, I'll be trying to answer the questions. Because, you know, I have an LEO background, so I do a lot of interview and interrogation in my past.
Oh, really?
And that's the thing is I don't want to treat it as an interview or an interrogation. I kind of want to just leave it open-ended, like ask you about your background, kind of flesh out the conversation.
But you must inherently just bring in some of those skills.
I do, but I...
Which ones?
It's just the rapport building. You know, you always have to start out.
What's that? Waterboarding?
No, sorry.
rapport building.
It's funny because when I got back from the war, I actually went to work for DOD for a bit, working the Guantanamo Bay investigation. This was post waterboarding, and that's everything. Anybody that knows I did that was always like, "Do you know how to waterboard?" I'm like, "No, I don't."
Yeah, could you waterboard me just to see what it's like? Yeah.
So where can we find you?
Well, I have a website, markvalley.com. It's under construction right now, but I'm on Twitter at YesMarkValley. Instagram, YesMarkValley. No, Instagram, just MarkValley. And go to markvalley.com. It'll show you everything. And I have my podcast is called The Live Drop. It's on iTunes.
Actually, why don't you talk about that podcast real quick? Because, I mean, I have not listened to it yet. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk to you first and kind of get an idea of what it's about. And I'm sure the audience would love that too.
Sure. Yeah. I started writing a pilot. I was stationed in Berlin around the time the wall came down, and Berlin was, you know, it's the spy capital. There were 31 different intelligence agencies operating from various flags at the time. And I remember just taking it for granted. It was a little bit boring. It was like, oh God, this Cold War stuff. Will you stop asking me the questions, stranger, you know? But then I became a little more interested in it. Afterwards, I was writing a pilot about this special operations guy who goes back to Berlin to answer to his, you know, his past, and he just is a Stasi nemesis. And I was doing a lot of research and was talking to people from that community there. And I thought, well, there's some very interesting people. And I had some interesting conversations. But also what was interesting is they were difficult. I'd never been an interrogator or anything like that. But I thought these are very challenging conversations because there's not really a lot people can talk about, as far as like practical things, what they were doing, sources and methods and all that stuff. So I thought, well, this would be a kind of a cool podcast. So I kept that in mind. And then about a year ago, I started, starting with some of those people that I initially talked to, put a podcast together. I started as a co-host with Pete Turner, who's probably someone you want to have on your show. He's a veteran, really skilled guy in the podcast world. He's kind of helped me figure out the technology, some of the techniques of interviewing. And he really kind of gave me my start. I co-hosted on his show, The Break It Down Show. So
and I started my own. Pete's been helping me out with my trying to get the audio down for this. I've had such tough issues in the beginning, but Pete's really helping me out. So I definitely have to have him on the show as well.
Yeah, I have Pete. You talk to Pete too. I'm like, how do I do this? Let me call Pete.
I know. He's awesome. Because I got one of those Zoom H6s and I'm like, how do you use this thing?
Like, Pete, hey, can I talk to you? Listen, just a minute. I'm talking with this Filipino chef who's like front man for like a rock band in Indonesia. Okay. Well, call me after. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, thanks a lot for coming on, Mark. I'm going to have you on again soon. Get some more questions prepared for you that have kind of really wanted to learn more about your different aspects of your podcasting, just different points of view. So that'd be great.
Yeah. I'd love to hear about your experience in the military as well. I'm always fascinated with guys who are, interrogating and using human intelligence to get information. It's
definitely.
Cool. Thanks
a lot, Mark.
All right, bye.